This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Yeah, I often start out a lot of my talk by saying I'm deaf, and of course, I know most of you, so it's pretty obvious. But just a good reminder, because if there's something I'm saying that you don't understand, you can just give me a little high sign, and I can repeat myself. You won't, like I say, you won't offend me. I know I'm deaf. You're not offending me, but ask me to repeat myself. So today I want to talk a little bit about death. I'm deaf, and I'm talking about death. I'm going to get that out of the way. And I wanted to start with talking a little bit about the Kula Malunkyo Vada Sutra. Forgive my butchering of the pronunciation, stumbling through that, but it basically means the short instructions to Malunkya. So Malunkya was one of the Buddha's followers. He was a monk in Buddha's time, and was practicing arduously. And he was sitting in seclusion. So that's kind of like what they would do. Like they would come together and hear a talk and practice together, but also kind of go out and sit among the trees in seclusion too. So I just feel like, I don't know, that's Jikoji's way too. Here we are. So he was out sitting in seclusion, and he arose and returned to the Buddha and asked about the quote-unquote, the questions that have been set aside. So Malunkya was sitting, and he realized, yes, it's M-A-L-U-N-K-Y-A. Malunkya, I don't know. Hindi is a lot closer than English is to this. Maybe you can help us. Yeah. Buddha, yeah, Buddha. We used to say Buddha.
Like old man.
Like old man, the old man. Old man, old yellow faces, with the... They call him in a lot of the koans and in the sutra, it'll come up as old yellow face. They have these kind of nicknames for him that almost sound like insults, but that comes up. They call him, the old man. And things. Okay, anyway. So Malunkya was sitting in seclusion, and he arose and he returned to the Buddha, and he asked him about the questions that had been set aside. Now, some of these questions that have been set aside are things like, after death, the Buddha exists. After death, the Buddha does not exist. After death, the Buddha does not exist and exists. After death, and so on and so forth. Some of these are the questions that have been set aside. So Malunkya was sitting, and he realized that the Buddha was dodging these questions. He wasn't answering them. So he said, I have to know this, So he approached the Buddha and sat at his side, and he said, if you do not answer this, I will renounce my training and return to a lower life. He basically said, if you don't finally give me an answer to these questions, I'm going to disrobe. I'm going to no longer be a monk. Like he's putting it all on the line there, So, I don't think he's being melodramatic. I think what he's saying is, I was off sitting in meditation, and these questions arose for me, and they're very, very real. And I'm at such an impasse in my practice. Here I am. I'm stuck up against this. And I'm ready. I'm ready to, even if it means disrobing. And I think that's a place that we've all come to in our practice, or will come to in our practice, is this, you know, grappling with some of these big questions. And that's part of what Nehane is about. And I could just picture Mulunkya. Think, what happens after I die? What happens after I die, but if I've achieved realization? Then what happens? Do I suffer the same fate then? So in researching this topic a little bit, the word asintya, the incomprehensible, or the surpassing thought. So these are the surpassing thought questions. So I was searching, and so I Googled a little bit about this asintya. And the first hit was a Wikipedia page for the four imponderables and the 10 indeterminate questions of Buddhism. Basically, a Wikipedia page that says the unanswerables. That was the slug. The URL was Wikipedia/Buddhism/the unanswerables or something like that. I thought that was a very, I don't know, it's hilarious to me. You know, when I was coming up, I couldn't just Google these things. But the fact that there's a web page dedicated to the questions that Buddha didn't answer. There it is, hanging out in the ether, you know, like a jewel on Indra's net. Questions he would not answer. .org, you know. So this term, this asintya term, is used to describe really the ultimate reality that is beyond all conceptualization. In other words, thoughts hereabout should not be pursued because they are not conducive to the attainment of liberation, what Buddha said. You know, he just straight up said, don't go there. Don't pursue these questions. And for the curious among you, because we're not supposed to go there, let's go there. Let's talk about it. The four imponderables. I just find this really interesting, really fun. The four imponderables of Buddhism are to ponder the Buddha range of Buddhas is the first imponderable. So basically to ponder the range of powers a Buddha might develop as the result of becoming a Buddha, but you should not ponder that. Like, don't think about pink elephants. Moving on. Yeah. Number two, the jhana range of one absorbed in the jhanas. So the range of powers that one may obtain while absorbed in meditation. The precise working out of the results of karma. We should not ponder that. We should not know that. And then four, speculation about the origin of the cosmos, as it is an improbable to be speculated about, and develops this speculation as indeterminate. And this is the language of the sutras. So those are the four imponderables. And then we have the 10 indeterminate questions. So you should not determine or not whether or not the world is eternal, is the first one, and it goes on. But the last four are whether or not the Tathagata exists after death. Number eight is whether the Tathagata does not exist after death. Number nine is whether or not the Tathagata both exists or does not exist after death. And the final being the Tathagata neither existing nor not existing. It's what's known in this kind of early Indic philosophy as the tetralemma. Thank you very much. It's what's known as the tetralemma, you know, examining these questions. Is not, is and is, both is and is not, you know, and looking at all sides of the thing. And it was very, it was a kind of foreground. because a lot of Buddhist, early Buddhist philosophy was looking at this stuff. Philosophy in India before that was looking at this stuff. And a lot of religious movements were trying to answer these questions. And so this was coming about. And so they were trying to hold Buddha's feet to the fire and say, well, could you answer this already? And he didn't answer. He says, Malunkya Putta, did I ever say to you, come Malunkya, live the holy life under me, and I will declare to you that the cosmos is eternal, or that the cosmos is not eternal. Buddha wouldn't answer his metaphysical questions. Why? Why would he answer this? So this is a kind of a debated thing in Buddhism. And he goes on to say, did I ever say I would set these questions to rest? And Malunkya says, no, Lord, no. So he goes on, did I ever say this? No, Lord, did I ever say, you know, it's the sutras, very repetitive, very song-like, back and forth. Did I ever say this? That I would ever lay this question to rest? No, no, Lord. If that is the case, who is the foolish man in front of me making these demands? Well, I could see Malunkya being like, it doesn't answer it. You know, I've got a real question. And I don't think this is about philosophy anymore. I think this is really real. And I think also because the sutras are very repetitious and sing-songy, it sounds like they're having a little fun tete-a-tete, but I could imagine this being very, very real. So the Buddha goes on and tells the famous arrow covered in poison story. So that's where that comes from. It comes from the Malunkya Sutta. And we all, I think, know that story. You know, somebody arrives shot with an arrow, or in some versions, shot full of arrows, you know, but shot with an arrow covered in poison. And while the family goes to get a surgeon, it says, you know, the victim of the shooting refuses to be treated. He says, I won't have this arrow removed until I know whether the man who wounded me was a noble warrior or a Brahmin or a merchant or a worker. So I won't have this arrow removed from me until I know whether the bowstring was wound with fiber, bamboo thread, sinew, hemp, or bark. Until I know, and it goes on like this. That was this oral tradition, right? And why were they undeclared by me? Because they are not connected with the goal. They are not fundamental to the holy life. They do not lead to disenchantment, dispassion, to the cessation, to the common. They do not lead to direct knowledge or self-awakening. They do not lead to unbinding. That's why they're undeclared by me. And Buddha basically goes on to say, I only teach the unbinding. But was the string like this? Was the shooter left-handed? You know, why did they? It's so silly, right? But is it? Because I was just doing that the other day. What did she really say about me? Why do you think she said that? Huh? You know, we all do this. And go after this. You know? I'm just like twisting it in. You know? I'm just saying, you know, this is just not. It's just, but wait, but tell me. Tell me about it. Tell me exactly how she said it, you know. That's not what we mean by see the situation clearly. And then we have this concept of zanshin, of the remaining mind. And I think about that a lot in Sesshin when we're sitting here together. This is such an intimate little Sesshin. And because of that, the energy happened very quickly. The container kind of happened very quickly. It's not always the case. We all got to work. Best we could, we all got to work, I think. And yeah. And when we clear everything else away, what remains? I can feel myself move into the moment in a fresh and alive way. And then I can feel myself reach back for what just happened and try and drag it forward with me. You can feel that in Zazen. Instead of moving forward into freedom, into a space that allows, in a space that has all possibilities, that place where I just drop away and take a step forward into each fresh moment, I can feel myself holding on to that thing, that story, that identity, whatever it is, and just dragging it forward moment after moment. And I think it's Sesshin where we go, oh, this is heavy to lift, to drag, to carry on. So when all things are dropped away and we have just what is remaining mind, or essential mind, we're just meeting that moment clearly, whatever that moment is, even if that moment is, oh, my knee, you know? And it's not about taking that last moment forward with us. So how can we completely see and meet this moment? Well, that comes from our practice. And I just practice more and more. But in the moment when I feel myself caught up in something else that's not this moment, sometimes I just ask myself a question. Like Sensei yesterday was saying things like, who's the one that? Who's the one? But sometimes I ask myself, who's the one? You know, or what in this moment is lacking? What's lacking? I just ask myself that. What's lacking right here, right now? Is there something lacking? 99% of the time, no. And I go, ah. Oh. And sometimes I go, yes. You need to get the fire extinguisher. Oh, okay. Sometimes we have to act, we have to change, we have to show up, and that's okay. Then you do that. Most of the time, this moment is not lacking. Neither are we as the moment. So you can see the completeness of this moment, and you can see how it is not lacking. And you can also see how your efforts to improve this moment are also not lacking. You can improve the moment, you can work with the moment, you can have that dance, as long as you don't try and control the experience. Right? You just have to really be part of the experience, your own experience, even if that's all you're connected with. I have a friend that I hope to bring here and do a dual streams retreat. He's a dear friend of mine. He's an Episcopal priest and a mystic. You know, I mean, he meditates and does all these things, and oh, he would fit it right in here, you know. But one of his mystic trainings and traditions is he does clown training. He does circus training. So he lives in this little town in Virginia and runs this Episcopal church. And, you know, they have their little the pride flag that they hang outside, you know. And that's spicy. You know? That's interesting in Virginia, you know. And they have their little parade day in town. And the church, they carry a little banner. And my friend, the know, the right Reverend so and so, he's out there on his unicycle, juggling with a nose on and his some vestments. All are welcomed with love, he says, juggling. And everybody's just, what the heck is that? Anyway, so in his clown training, he was studying with this very famous clown recently. And they participate in this kind of clowning that's not like getting up on stage and just acting out a routine. It's instead going out into the marketplace and getting mixed up with everything. And, you know, he says that and my proverbial ears prick up, you know, because this is Zen training, right? This is Zen. Go back into the marketplace and get all mixed up with everybody and learn how to see and how to respond. So I asked him about his recent clowning retreat. I feel like, oh, on a clowning retreat. I asked him about his recent clowning retreat. And kind of like what some of his favorite moments were. And he shared with me a teaching that the teacher said. He said, kind of clowning like this all boils down to one thing. Don't be interesting, just be interested. As a clown, don't be interesting, just be interested. So you join the dance, don't perform. No. Flow, co-create. It's much more fun, much more challenging sometimes, much more alive, much more fun. So I have a little Zen koan that's also kind of related to this that I would like to read. One day, in the neighborhood of Dogo's temple, a death occurred in a certain home, and Zen Master Dogo took his disciple, Zengen, to express the condolences to the family. This is probably a traditional thing to go read the sutras of the family's author, something like that. And during the visit, Zengen tapped on the coffin and said, "Is he alive or dead?" Dogo answered, "I won't say alive, won't say dead." Zengen said, "Why don't you say?" Dogo repeated, "Won't say, won't say." On the way back to the temple, Zengen again asked, "Please tell me clearly, Master, whether he is dead or alive. If you don't tell me, I'll hit you." The teacher said, "Hit me if you like. But I won't say, I won't say." So Zengen hit him. Sometimes people end the Quran there because that's kind of the main body of the point. But there's a secondary point. So for sake of completion, I'd like to read the last few sentences. At length, Dogo died. And Zengen, still troubled by his question, went to see Sekiso, a well-known Zen teacher. He told Sekiso how years ago he had struck his old teacher because he would not answer his question of life and death. He then repeated the same question to Sekiso, and Sekiso said, "I won't say alive, I won't say dead, I won't say, I won't say." At that, Zengen came to realization. There's actually more to it. There's this more that I won't read, but then they later find him with a hoe, with a rake, pacing back and forth through the center of the temple. And they say, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm looking for the master's relics." You know, he's going to go dig the master up and kind of venerate his bones. Like, I get it now. I get it now after all these years. And, well, this is funny because it's a koan about death. And it also echoes a bit of what Mulunkya was saying. And, you know, what's really funny is that a lot of us, when we're going or we're experiencing these big losses and transitions in our life, experiencing death, we try to reach into the teachings, you know. Let me find a koan about death, because that's what we do. I want that comfort. I want that, you know, place. I want to find myself in this place. You know, I'll go to my teacher, like Malumkya. And it's so funny because when we reach for a koan like this, that's about death. And that's what we want. You know, we want certainty. We want somebody to say, this is how it's going to be. It's going to be all right. And the thing is Zen only offers, well, not that. Offers deep, deep unknowing, not knowing. You know, and when you hear this, the student ready to slug his teacher, you know, ready to, you know. And this is at a time when students and teachers all live together like this, sometimes for decades of their lives. Or sometimes they were even raised by their teacher, taking on a teacher's last name, you know. So this idea of, if you don't tell me, I'm going to slug her. If you don't tell me, I'm going to take my robe off right now. I can feel the desperation. I can feel the reaching. This is a very sensitive time. It's a time for the teacher to apply the right kind and the right amounts of pressure. And what does the teacher do? Backs away. Completely. Nothing but space, nothing but air, nothing but a free fall. What could be a better preparation for our life than a teacher setting you up for a little free fall? At a lot of temples and monasteries, they chant the evening gatha, and instead of the refuges. And it goes something like, great is the matter of birth and death, no forever, gone, gone, awake, awake, each one. Do not waste your life. Or awaken. Do not squander your life. And there's different versions of it. So in this koan, there's also commentaries by the masters. You know, basically the writing between the lines, the marginalia, if you will. And they're usually quite illuminating as well. Hearing his anguished cry for help, the old adept kindly shows him again, it says. And then, that's the most kindness he could show him. If you don't tell me, I'm going to slug you. And he just goes, I won't say. I won't say. He just leans into it, knowing full well this is what the student needs. And the funniest thing is when we first read this koan, you think, what a bastard. What a bastard, you know? And then when you look at it, you go, as the commentary says, it goes on, you know, talking about relentless in his kindness, he exposes his hearts and guts, holds nothing back. What is he giving him, though? You should say it quickly for my teacher. You should say it quickly for me, teacher, or I will hit you. Hit me if you will, but I will not say. After he hits him, Zengen tells him, you should take your leave for a while, because No, this is what he says. You should take your leave for a while. I'm afraid if the head monk finds out about this, that you've hit me, he will make trouble for you. It's like saying, okay, Ross, yeah, I mean, you can slug me, but Mariko is going to find out. The Ino is going to find out. You better run. And then it says, at length, Dogo died. That means sometime later, at length, Dogo died. But it also takes all of Dogo's life and then says, at length, he died. Like, and there were some things that happened, and then it was over. I just find, just made this whole point and spilled his whole guts out. And then the very next line is, oh, that now that he's dead, we can talk about the rest of it. It's kind of fascinating to me. But it says, at length he died. And then the commentary under that is, where did he go? So even the masters, piling on to the masters, won't let us wiggle free. Where did he go? So it's so important for us to have a taste of this ourselves, have a taste of this no self, this to deeply experience that. And the Sesshin is a time to do that. We have to learn here how to kind of cultivate it and dance with it and respond to it. And like Nenzen Sensei was saying, that that's just all of samsara and nirvana is. Samsara is the endless cycle of birth and death. But in our own hearts and minds, it's that spinning around and not letting ourselves have release. And moving from moment to moment, just spinning around, dragging everything with us instead of just going ahead. How could I say what it is and what it isn't? How could I make it a box for you to put everything in? How could I say? Why would I say? I feel you, student, in a free fall, falling through your life. It hurts. So does love. So does everything. But you're falling through your life right now. Why would I give you anything to get ensnared on, to entangle yourself with? Why would I give you a box that says, this is life, so that you could put something outside of it and say, this is not life? This is death. And say, well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. Spinning and spinning of samsara. Or, in other words, not falling into any traps that we repeatedly set ourselves for ourselves with our egos, our stories, our cultures. There's a haiku by Busan. Before the white chrysanthemum, the scissors hesitate but a moment. Just literally the sparsest of kanji, just a few little strokes. And it sets a whole scene, a whole teaching. Hesitation. The white flowers for the altar. Clinging. The person. The moment. That whole pregnant pause. You know, just each ancestor realized this no self and carried it forth. It's 80 some generations to us here in this time. You can feel it. You know, if you're having trouble feeling it, go into the Kaisando in the morning. Make some prostrations. So there is a spark there. We have to find it. Maybe there is something that dies and there is something that doesn't die, but maybe that's not our work. Because we understand, yeah, each basic part of me, from the calcium, the iron, and all that stuff goes back into the earth. And we say, yeah, part of that energy, matter, conservation of it, and all of that continues. Get that. And all that, by the way, was born in a star. Back when I'm not supposed to be pondering.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.